Radke is a punk band from St. Joe made up of three brothers who started the band when they were 13, 15, and 17 years old. They've been written up in the New York Times. They've toured all over the place. They've played big festivals and gotten really international attention. This is their latest single. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now that the Radke brothers are home from their latest tour, we're catching up with them for the first time since their big break. Isaiah D. Solomon, hello.
Hey, what's up?
How's it going?
Good. Tell me about your tour, first of all. You're just back home, right?
Yes. Just got back. Been home for maybe a week. Yeah.
What do you do when you're home?
We pretty much just play video games and watch TV, movies and stuff, and write music, but right now we're like kind of chilling out. Got a couple days after a lot of road time.
Yeah, what was the tour like? Where'd you go?
Oh man, we went to Buffalo, New York. We went to
Washington, D.C. and like Rochester, mm-hmm. New York.
Kingston.
And Toronto.
Toronto. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia.
Boston. Any good stories from the road?
I mean, pretty much just like the shows were so much fun, like really good, big, fun shows, like really good stretch of that.
So what's the story behind the new single or newish single at this point, Not Smart?
We had been a band for a long time and we've been doing it for longer than we've been doing anything, which is kind of trippy. And you kind of grow up and then things start kind of, you know, and it start getting hard. We moved to Kansas City and then things were just harder than we thought they were going to be. So
hard in what way?
Hard in like, you know, things like, you know, we didn't play as many shows at a point, mm-hmm. and we kind of like were getting older. So the band was kind of like starting over in some ways just because we weren't like the young band anymore. So that was kind of happening. So
at least not young on the level of like, when you first started, it was almost a novelty how young
were. It wasn't that kind of thing anymore. Yeah, so like once you go through that kind of change, then you have to like, you know, write some new music. So we were writing new songs in the middle of that kind of time and being home and kind of just like, man, what's going to happen next? And so that song's kind of like about that time and yeah, just like just that kind of downtime we had, that weird time in the band.
Yeah, Solomon, what changed for you as you got older and had to start thinking about your music differently?
Oh, man. I think kind of just, like, becoming, like, an adult, weird, alone, and, like, starting a band as a kid or whatever, then being this age just, like, is different or whatever.
What about you, Dee?
Yeah, I think, you know, just growing up and, you know, traveling and stuff like that has changed me a lot. I think, you know, my opinions have changed. My mind has been expanded, has opened a lot.
Is that partly a matter of all the touring, do you
think? Yeah, definitely. Getting out into the world after, you know, being, you know, at the house all the time, you know.
Yeah, because you guys mm-hmm. grew up being homeschooled.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it was really, really cool. Like, we got a lot of, like, free time to do whatever we wanted mm-hmm. to do and kind of, like, be ourselves and you know, kind of figure out that we wanted to do music. And that was really cool. Like, we're really glad Mom and Dad decided to take that route because we had plenty of time to work on becoming, you know, good at what we were trying to do. So that was really cool.
Yeah. How did it work? I mean, did you guys initiate it?
Well, Dad had a lot of music And we saw that movie School of Rock, and then that got us really excited. So we started listening to, Dad had a lot of the music from that movie.
Am I remembering the movie right? The Jack Black movie?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
just checking.
Totally. Yeah, so that had a lot of good music in it. So Dad had a lot of that, and then that got us pretty excited. So we listened to all that, and D really did the most music. I kind of dropped out of it, and after a while, Saul and I got into it.
So Dee, this was originally like really your passion, it sounds like.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do music. I actually started off playing the drums for quite a while, and then I took drumming lessons and that killed it for me.
Oh,
I'm self-taught, you know, they wanted me to like learn all the math and music theory behind it, and I just wanted to play, so I just went to guitar and stuck with that for a while and then kind of progressed from there.
So you seem to really like to be, like, self-guided.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, just, you know, that's always been the way, I am. So, like, you know, I like to do things on my own rather than being forced to do things and, you know.
Like having someone over your shoulder.
Yeah, having someone over my shoulder, like, you know.
I've always been a shoulder guy.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, growing up and being homeschooled and loving that, because it sounds like it gave you the opportunity to pursue music really in a different way. But also, do you ever wonder if there's stuff you missed out on, like just rites of passage that other kids experience at school?
Yeah, and that's definitely a weird thing. Like, we were really weird for a long time.
Weird in what way?
Well, we just weren't very social. Like, mm-hmm. We didn't know how to talk to people or anything like that. So, without being just coming off really weird. So, but the music, I mean, traveling and stuff and, like, you know, talking to sound guys and all that. Like, you just learn how to do everything. We learned how to do everything on the road pretty much. Like, and that's like a hardcore like lifestyle. So like now life is just like it's a lot easier to do once you've had to do like the super hard version.
Yeah. And so talk to me a little bit more about when you went from being a band that was just forming within your own home, as siblings will do, you know, play music together, to being like, no, we're a band.
Yeah, we were jamming out a lot, and then Dee had a couple songs, and those two songs we thought sounded awesome, so we were like, man, we could really actually be a band for real now that we've got all, like, the vocals and, like, all the stuff kind of happening together. And so we just practiced every day until we got a gig for opening for Fishbone, which was cool. It was our first gig ever, and
that's huge. That's a huge first gig.
Yeah, they didn't ask how old, or no. They knew how old we were, but they didn't ask if we'd ever played a gig or like. They just asked if we had an hour or no, 30 minutes.
30 minutes,
which we didn't, but you had to take the gig anyways.
But wait, so how did they find out about you?
Our dad pretty much submitted us for it.
Yeah, a band dropped off the show.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we got to do that show. It was really scary. We thought we were going to be famous right after. We thought we were famous afterwards because it was a huge show. And, like our first show was so big. So we were, like, sweet.
We're famous now.
Yeah. So we booked another show, like, the next week or something at that venue. And there was, like, two people there or something like that. And that was, like, the band. And it was so harsh, like, the smackdown. Like, it was so funny. Like, you think about it all the time. But then you're always chasing that original, you know, amazing vibe.
So we are listening to what most people would consider your breakout song, Romance Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about this song and how it changed things.
Yeah, this is probably the biggest song we had written, the first big song we wrote, with like just a bunch of changes and stuff like that, and just had like a big hook, and it was really kind of powerful. Like, it took a lot of work from all three of us, and it was just super rocking. Like, everything we had ever really wanted in a song, we finally had the skills to write it, so we were stoked.
Yeah, let's listen just a little bit. What is it like to listen to this? Like, you've talked about growing up since your beginnings, but I see you all bopping your head, like, the exact same way.
That's so funny. Yeah, it's, You gotta write the music you wanna hear.
You know, your race has been a part of your experience. We've talked about that before. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the punk scene, which can be very white.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you know, black people have always been, you know, the pioneers of this kind of music, rock music and stuff like that. Like, if you look back into history, you know, through, you know, blues and, oh, look up Sister Rosetta Tharpe. She was, like, straighting on the guitars, like, in, like, what, the 60s or, like, 50s, 60s, something like that. It was pretty crazy. Yeah.
I mean, what have your experiences been like within the larger punk scene?
I would say they've been really easy and chill. Like, it's the scene that we're in, like the rock scene, punk scene or whatever, is like really awesome. So it was really easy to get in there, and there was never really any kind of like weirdness or like, you know, standoff.
You know, I mean, we've talked about this before, but Solomon, for you in particular, you were so young when this band started, 13. And how old are you now?
I'm 20 now.
The difference between a 13-year-old and a 20-year-old, I mean, that's like different people.
Mm-hmm.
How is the band itself different for you now that you're 20 and, not a kid? You're not a kid.
Man, as far as the band goes, I feel like it's always felt like generally like the same and comfortable, because we're always so close to where it's like we're like the same age mentally. So I feel like we all have, it's always felt kind of the same for all of us, I think.
What about your parents? I mean, you've mentioned your dad quite a bit, just that he had this music collection and everything, but how have they been part of this journey?
Well, Dad is he's our tour manager and our manager as well, so so we do everything together. Like, yeah, so we've kept it in the family like the whole time, so everything's super chill. Like, but yeah, that's the thing, is everything feels the same. It's just that we just get older, you know, and that's kind of what like Not Smart's about, you know, like things just start changing. Like, you feel the same the whole time, but. Maybe your body starts to hurt a little bit more or something after a show, and you're just like, wait a second, you know, things that would heal fast when you're 17, and then you realize it's like, you know, you're 22 now, and you're like, oh man.
Old man at 22.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, wow, things like my back, what?
But wait, you caught that I was being sarcastic there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, but like you're saying, having your dad be your tour manager is super chill. Not everyone would say that about having their dad be their manager. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, not everyone would say that.
Yeah, like everything's like super easy. We could do whatever we want, like, because we don't really do that much. All we do is kind of hang and play shows. So, like, it's a really easy, smooth, like everyone knows each other, it's all good.
Where do you see the future of the band?
Man, hopefully just keep getting like playing big shows and stuff and get like another album out. It's the next goal. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you guys are from St. Joe. How do those roots affect your sound, or is that an important part of, you know, you just have shows like in Washington, D.C., you've toured London. Like, when you're in those places, do you still feel like being from St. Joe is important?
Yeah, like, I always feel St. Joe, like, it never, like, goes away. Like, I would say it's a huge part of our sound and who we are. Like, I don't know, it definitely wouldn't be the same if we hadn't come from there. Like, I don't know, there's just something about just the how we were raised, and then just like the kind of shows we played after we were allowed to play there, and you know, just like all that experience, you know, it all definitely goes in to the music.
Tell me about your local shows as soon as you were old enough to be in the venues.
Well, they are not the best. We still can't sell one out, but it's still really fun.
Yeah,
like St. Joe's weird. Like, it's hard to draw people in St. Joe, like no matter what. But we do have some fun shows at the Rendezvous when we do play. So we do play there every once in a while.
I have heard that it was the local audience was in some ways hardest for you guys to win over.
Yeah, it's strange, but I think that goes for everyone who's from there. Like, it's just a tough audience, and you know, Missouri in general is pretty tough to, like, you know, any band will tell you it's a kind of hard sometimes coming through.
Why?
I don't know. I just think it's just harder to impress audiences in Kansas City and in St. Joe and stuff. I don't know. Like, it's just kind of like...
Show me state? Is this for real?
Yeah. We can get bored fast. I get bored really fast at shows. Like, I suck. I'll leave... yeah, it's so funny. I'll leave halfway through. Just because I do it all the time. I don't know. Even if it's the best show, I'm just like... Maybe it's this the Missouri part of me. I'm just like, I'm in it for a bit, then I'm ready to go in like 25 minutes or something.
Well, we're talking to the band Radke. They're from St. Joe, as you've just heard, and they've made it pretty big. They started when they were really young, 13, 15, and 17. I want to listen to a song before we go that's gotten a lot of love. Let's listen to a little bit of Dark Black Makeup. Song, like the lyrics, first of all, it seems like it's about kids these days. Do you feel like you've had to be like the spokesman for kids these days and represent?
Well, it's like kind of like about you know, when you go to a rock show and you stand in the back and you're just being weird. It's kind of like about, you know, waking up and like enjoying the moment that you chose to be a part of instead of just like being weird and too cool for it, you know? Like, that's something that's just never translated to us, because like we like to like enjoy that moment, like, you know.
Do you think being homeschooled is part of that? It seems like that would, like, the pressure that kids feel in school to be one of the cool kids, mm-hmm. like that I'm guessing that doesn't exist when there are three of you who are brothers.
Yeah, that's one of our main things, is we don't really care about how cool we are. We don't try to be cool. We just be ourselves. I mean, that sounds really generic, but like, we're just like, it's just, we like what we do. And like, some of the things that we're into, like comics and stuff, have become cool, you know, over the years. So that's nice. But, you know, we just always do what we do and rock it out.
But even in a family, you get a reputation as like, you know, maybe one of the kids is like the loud one, or one of the kids is the like athletic one, or something like that. Do you guys have your own reputations within the family?
Probably a little bit. Like, I'm definitely the one who talks the most.
I've noticed that. And Dee, you seem like maybe you're pretty quiet.
I guess I'm probably the second quietest, I guess.
What would you say is your like role in the family?
Role? Big brother.
You're the big brother?
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Big bro.
Big bro. I don't know. I don't really know how that, I mean, it's fine.
He likes it.
Yeah. I don't really think about it.
Do you think that being a big brother is different on the road?
Not really. I mean, we all, no one, not like, I'm not like, you know, the guy that's like trying to keep everyone in line or whatever, you know, so.
He's the budget in check.
Yeah. I don't,
when we're at a gas station, we all look to D.
Yeah.
And Solomon, what about you? Which brother are you, if you're thinking about it that way?
I feel like a lot of people would refer to me as the quiet one, mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah, I mean...
What's it like to be the quiet one in a punk band?
Well, I don't really consider myself quiet. That's kind of just like what people would assume it is or whatever. But yeah, I think that would be what how people would describe
He's
as far
not
as family
coming
goes.
At you with like conversation.
Yeah,
but if you got something to say, he'll talk to you.
Well, so thinking about just your band and its future and like what it's meant to you within your family, I have noticed that your band has a Y on the end,
mm-hmm.
and your last name Radke does not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people could never pronounce our last name, so we figured with the band, we'll definitely throw a Y on the end and just help it all. Yeah, people mispronounce our name all the time. We got like Radic a lot, you know.
So, what are you working on now?
We are working on new songs, working on just like jamming out for tours and stuff. Just, but yeah, really important is new songs and the next record.
What are you looking forward to about being at home for a while? How long are you home before your next tour? Or do you have a next tour scheduled?
I think we have like 2 months off at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to Europe next year, so we're also gearing up for that. We're going to like Germany and stuff.
Mm-hmm. What are you thinking about as you plan for a tour of Europe?
Oh, just enjoying our time here until it's time to have to rely on Wi-Fi all the time for your phone and all of that. It's going to be really cool. We haven't been over there in a second, so that we're looking forward to it a lot. But we're going to miss the cats and stuff, so just got to live that home vibe for a while. Take it all in.
The home vibe, hanging out with the cats.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Isaiah, Solomon, D, the Radke brothers, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We've been talking to the band Radke, originally from St. Joe, and KCUR's Central Standard continues in just a minute. Stay tuned. Let's take a trip back to the year 2015. The refugee crisis in Europe was what all the media outlets were talking about. Syrians fleeing devastation back home were arriving mostly in boats on European shores in huge numbers. More than 1 million migrants crossed into Europe that year. Like I said, this was covered extensively in the news, but the only place I've heard about it through the lens of Syrians and Germany going on dates is the NPR podcast Rough Translation. In this clip, a guy named Aktam is remembering a woman he met in Germany who asked for his number.
Actually, she was the one to make the first move and ask me for my number. And it was like a few months after what happened in
Cologne. The news
Cologne.
Of what happened in the city of Cologne on New Year's Eve has electrified Germany.
That mass assault.
More than 1,000 men.
The vast majority of the suspects are believed to be migrants or refugees.
People had ideas about refugees.
I was touched from behind my back and I was touched under my skirt and my butt.
A few days later, this German med student, she surprised him again. She texted him an invitation to go swimming.
Public swimming baths closed its doors on men from the local refugee center.
Swimming pools have become a kind of symbol of a space in Germany where refugee men are seen as intruders.
5 schoolgirls complained that they'd been groped by a group.
I just responded with a really dumb response. I just said, I would love to go, but I actually can't swim.
The host of that podcast, Gregory Warner, finds and tells stories about emotional encounters that are international encounters, and they help us look at the news in a different light. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Gregory's joining us now from NPR to talk about the network's first international podcast, Rough Translation. Gregory, good morning.
Thanks, Gina. Good morning.
So, listening back to that clip, what did the trials and tribulations of Syrians looking for dating advice in Germany reveal to you about what some might call more serious issues?
Well, I mean, Aktham's predicament is very much the predicament for so many of us who find themselves in a new culture that we're trying to navigate. You're trying to figure out the rules. You're trying to figure out the customs. Even more so, though, if everybody in the news is talking about you and creating, you're sort of dealing with the stereotypes, and you're dealing with them, wondering whether you should not make a move because you'd be seen as a predator. That is so much of what, I mean, informs the refugee crisis right now, because we're not just talking to each other. We are we're talking to our idea of the other. And getting a distance on how we talk about each other is important to understand how we're actually having this dialogue. For instance, Akhtham, he doesn't even want to go on any date. He's super shy. Partly he's just a shy guy, but also because he's so terrified of being the monster that he reads about in the news. It's only when he meets a German flirt coach, which is a big thing in Germany, apparently, dating coaches, that she actually helps him figure out what went wrong in that date and how he can decode German culture.
There was a hug at the end of the date that he's pretty sure wasn't it, but he's also worried about this phone call where he says he can't swim.
Exactly, and that hug haunted him for about a year and a half afterward. He thought a lot about that hug in the silence there. I felt very much for Akhtham, but I also felt that Akhtham got an opportunity to do something that almost none of us get to do, which is to see around ourselves. He was staring at these texts. He was wondering, right, with the swimming pool, was that the issue? Was the hug held for a few seconds too long or something? And in fact, what he was doing wrong, I don't want to give it away, let people listen, but what he was doing wrong was something else, and it was something he couldn't see, and he therefore couldn't talk about. And that's so often the case with cultural miscommunication. It's not the thing we think that we did wrong or the thing that we think everyone's talking about. It's this other thing. You know, I've had that so often in international environments where I didn't realize something I did was interpreted in a different way, and I didn't realize that was actually the conversation that was going on. So many of our episodes really deal with the invisible in that way.
You know, when you talk about your experiences in other cultures, you have a lot of that kind of experience. I mean, you were NPR's East Africa correspondent for years. I'm curious about how your own experience being, I don't know, like that interloper in someone else's territory, how that informs your perspective on international news.
Oh yeah, that's exactly where this the impetus for this came from. I mean, when we were first proposing this to NPR, the conversation was: look, we have 17 foreign bureaus across the world, and NPR is constantly delivering international news. We have a tremendous footprint and leverage that reporting and those contacts. But the thing about being a correspondent that doesn't always fit into the news magazines is the experience of trying to navigate another place, another culture. I mean, I've had, yes, exactly, so many experiences where I have to realize how to offer a bribe or how to avoid offering a bribe or any number of situations where you're figuring out how to translate your intention to another place. And really, when we think about why we travel, why any of us benefits from travel, it's not because we get to have some, you know, experience or taste something or see something. Of course, those are nice. But ultimately, the reason we travel is because we're trying to see around ourselves, get a different perspective. So that was the idea. That was the value proposition of the podcast, that we would take the length and we would set the platform to give correspondents the chance to talk about that journey.
But it's not usually the correspondent who's having that experience. It's usually the characters in the story.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It could be anybody. In this, and it's often multiple ways. I think always, every podcast, we do try to fit in moments where we're mistranslating. I mean, I'll just give you an example from the last season, for instance. I mean, I was in Ukraine in 2014. I lived in Ukraine before. I had returned for the territorial dispute that's going on with Russia. So Ukraine is right next to Russia. And everybody at that time had talked to me about this problem, which they called fake news. And I didn't mean anything to me in 2014, fake news. It just sounded, okay, I said, okay, I know that Russia is really good at propaganda. I guess there's some propaganda going over the border. So I basically kind of ignored it, even though people were telling me, no, this is ripping our citizens apart. This is ripping our country apart. And it was only until 2016 that I looked back on that reporting and realized, wait a second, Russia was honing techniques in there that they would later export around the world. And suddenly, you know, I realized that they were talking about something that we were about to anticipate, we were about to experience. I just didn't realize it at the time.
Yeah, your own experience hadn't made you like really able to hear what they were saying to you.
Exactly, exactly. And so I was seeing them through the lens of sort of what would be interesting to American audiences, which is often the lens that we have to take as correspondents. But suddenly, when I was back there, this was last year, reporting, I got to look at it from a perspective of, you know, sort of, if they are 2 years ahead of us, what can we learn from them now, looking into our future? And in fact, what I learned was kind of terrifying, but I think very prescient.
Can you that, give
well,
a hint?
That the, yeah, that basically, that fake news, the really sinister power of it is not what it makes us believe, but what it makes us doubt.
You know, and, yeah. There is an episode that is just heart-wrenching about a guy, an American guy, who was a POW in World War II. He's suffered post-traumatic stress ever since. Like, he can barely talk about what's happened to him, even in, like, an official capacity where people need to know what happened to you. But the story is actually about his need for an apology years later. And what is fascinating about that, among other things, I mean, you have to explain how apologies work in the Japanese language. You have to explain the personal histories of many characters. You have to do some explaining of World War II history. And despite having to do all of that, the main idea of this story is about how we all struggle with apologies. That's a lot.
I know. It is a lot. You know, it's funny, we... One of the things we deal with, I think, mostly in this podcast and when talking about it for people who haven't heard it yet, is the challenge of this word international. I call it sometimes the I word because it has a connotation that this is going to be a lot of information and history and stuff that I maybe don't know. In this case, what you're talking about is more American than many of our podcasts because it's about a war we're involved in. But I think that... What we're really talking about in that episode is the fact that I'm sorry can mean something so different in different cultures. And when we say sorry, we have this one word, I'm sorry. It does a lot. I mean, you can use it on the subway when you bump into somebody or the metro or whatever. And or you can use I'm sorry on, you know, national television if you're apologizing for a major instance of sexual harassment. So the question that we look at is, hey, in Japan, they have all kinds of different words for I'm sorry and many different kind of ladder of responsibility and shame. And you can dial up and dial down the degree of how sorry you feel. And so the story of a sorry that goes, in this case, from Japan to the United States, from a Japanese company to a single POW who's been waiting, as you said, 70 years for these words, is how do you say those words? And it's not just about translating that word itself, but translating kind of the whole sort of everything around what a sorry is and what we want from it.
Gregory, I don't mean to be flip, but are you aware that in the Midwest we have a form of sorry that's like the minor sorry that you were describing, and it's ope?
No, I totally don't know. Tell me about it.
You just go, ope, sorry. And you don't even have to add the sorry necessarily. Just one of those small things like on the subway. You should try it.
I'm going to be there reporting.
Well, Gregory Warner is the host of the NPR podcast Rough Translation. And Gregory, thanks for talking about it today.
Thank you so much for the chance to talk.
Up next, what to do with all your extra basil. Hint, you can drink it. Stay tuned. I I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, if you're a gardener who grows herbs around here, there's a good chance you're up to your ears in basil. If your freezer is already full of all the pesto you could possibly eat in the foreseeable future, we have an idea for you. It's called Basil Cello. Am I saying that right?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
I'm here with the Monarch Bar's Brock Schulte. He's the bar director, and he's the originator of their house-made Basil Cello. It's an infused basil-infused liqueur that they use in one of their cocktails on the summer menu. So, Brock, how did you first hear about Basil Cello?
Well, it was actually kind of selfish. I was looking for anything to make a cocktail green. So anything I could do to make the cocktail green, and I started looking up just old liqueurs and things like that, things you could do with fresh mint, fresh herbs, and I saw a recipe online that I found that said basil cello, and honestly, it was really, really easy. It's just a straight maceration, and then using high-proof liqueur that I sourced from J. Rieger & Co., and then I was able to sweeten and proof it down to where we could use it in our cocktails, and have a little right there for you if you like.
Yeah, okay. So I want to say that this is bright green. It looks like, do you remember, Scope?
Uh-huh.
It looks like mouthwash.
It absolutely looks like mouthwash. It tastes better.
I'm going to try it. We have how long left on the show? 15 minutes will be all right.
So it's super bright.
Oh, that is actually, okay, I think because it looks like mouthwash, I was ready for it to taste like mouthwash.
Right.
It does not. It's actually, even just by itself, really, I can taste the basil, and it's very smooth.
Big fan, yeah.
Okay, so explain how you do this.
So we really just took a lot of fresh basil, and we...
A lot, how much?
I like to make things all at once, so I don't have to make them again. And this menu is going to last 6 months long. So I actually made 5 gallons of basil cello at a time. And so that took us about 8 pounds of basil is what we used. And we
So if someone's got a ton of basil and they're like, I really don't know what to do.
I had a ton of basil.
Are you a gardener?
I am not a green thumb whatsoever. I have a lot of friends. We actually have a couple people on staff that really love it. Ben Miller, who actually has a greener demeanor, and he goes out and foraging all the time and finds stuff for us. It's really great.
Okay, so you take just an insane amount of basil, and you do what now?
So we macerated it in high-proof neutral spirit.
Macerated?
Yeah, so we literally just make sure that we put the basil into the high-proof spirit and then make sure that none of the basil is actually showing to the air. That way it can't oxidize and go brown. So it really forces...
Dunk it.
Correct, yeah. And we can use... Actually, you can use anything like a household plate or anything to keep it down.
Okay, and so how long does that go on?
We let that sit for 8 weeks, and then at the end of 8 weeks, we tried it, and it was this color, and I was like, there's no way this color is going to stay. It's unbelievable. Like, we thought it would brown and oxidize, but
Scope,
it's done well
another
since.
Reference I would make is a traffic light, green light, go.
Yeah, absolutely. And after that, we just sweetened it a little bit with heavy simple syrup, which is just a 2-to-1 simple syrup, and then proofed it down with filtered water and got it to
about... Simple syrup, for people who don't know, that's literally, that is water and sugar kind of simmered together.
Yeah, so we, I don't cook my simple syrups. We actually blend them, so it's faster, and you don't ever get a like caramelized flavor.
Okay, so this is an ingredient in one of the drinks, at least one of the drinks on your summer menu.
It's in one of the drinks on our Negroni list, on our Negroni's of Distinction, that's called the El Pili. And it's basically a white Negroni using the fresh basil cello.
Cool. Okay, so getting back to this basil cello concept, it sounds awesome, but remind me again how long you have to let it steep?
We did it for 8 weeks.
Right. So if you want to drink your basil tonight, this is not going to work.
Correct.
Our next guest has a speedier recipe. Emily Ferris used to be one of our food critics. She's a cocktail blogger and Instagrammer at Sidework Studios. And Emily, what is this drink that you have concocted for us today?
So this morning I made you a watermelon basil margarita. So I made some watermelon juice, blended down some watermelon and strained it. And then I make a basil simple syrup. I make mine differently than Brock, but I'm not making it for the masses. And I usually am just making it for, you know, whoever is reading my my blog to get a recipe and make it at home. But I do a 1-to-1 simple syrup, put on the stove. So 1 cup water, 1 cup sugar, bring it to a boil. Then I cut the heat, let it sit for about a minute, drop in a cup of fresh basil, and let that steep for 5 to 10 minutes.
Full leaves?
Yes. Though I like to break them up and put a little bit of stem and bruise them a little, though the heat will draw out the oils, because that's where you get the oils and the flavor. And so this particular margarita is fresh watermelon juice, the basil syrup, tequila, because of margarita, and some fresh squeezed lime juice. And I actually did a little pinch of sea salt in it. It is best when made very fresh. And I also make a similar version of this without making the basil simple syrup. I just do the watermelon, the tequila, the lime, a little salt, and I kind of pinch a fresh basil leaf. You know when you pick an herb, that's when you really smell it. Mm-hmm. So when you pinch it, you release some of the oils, and you can just kind of run it around the rim of your glass a little. Ooh. And because you know when you enjoy a drink, it's more than just the taste. You're smelling it too, so the fragrance of the basil really enhances the taste experience.
Emily has handed me some basil leaves, and I am trying what she has suggested. But Emily, are you is there basil already in this drink as
well?
There
is. So the basil simple syrup is in this drink, yes.
And then it's interesting to me that you put the salt in the margarita and the basil on the rim of the glass.
Yeah, I did that last year when I made this. I made this drink in a gorgeous vintage margarita glass. And it had a gold rim, and I didn't want to muck up the rim of my vintage margarita glass with salt. And I remembered my grandma putting salt on watermelon and how good that was.
Yeah,
I thought,
that's what I was thinking of when you were talking about salt. Like, my dad used to totally do that.
And I do that. I'll do that sometimes. If a drink, I feel like, oh, it needs a little something, I'll put a little pinch of sea salt in there. And I think it works really well for a margarita. Obviously, you can put it on the rim. But for certain drinks, I think it works just as well in the glass.
And watermelon, obviously, at least as summery as basil.
Yes. And yeah, that's kind of how I got the idea. People make, you know, watermelon and basil salads, and that's where I get my drink inspiration from, thinking of food combinations. So what's in season right now, what's really working, and that's where I thought basil with watermelon.
I'm going to try this real quick.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it is awesome. It's it is kind of like a salad, and it's kind of popsicle-y, if that is a word.
Yeah, the watermelon, it's the sweetness and the watermelon, and I don't have a lot of watermelon drinks. They're very seasonal. Today's the first day of summer, so it seemed, you know, watermelon and basil are two of the most summery ingredients you can get. So.
And the simple syrup with a 1-to-1 water-to-sugar ratio and some basil in it, like, that's all the sugar that's in here? Because it's also so sweet, and that's mostly the
absolutely.
Watermelon.
Yeah, I like I said, last summer I made a version of this without any syrup. So it was just watermelon, tequila, lime, and the sweetness of the watermelon came through. When it's really ripe, it's very sweet. And so you could do it this way, just kind of added a little extra basil kick. And I like to make a basil syrup and then use it in drinks throughout the week. It'll last a few weeks in the fridge. So I usually, when I make a drink, I make a bigger batch of syrup and then keep it in the fridge and, you know, use it, put it in LaCroix or another cocktail, anything.
So what is I want to talk to both of you about what makes a good summer cocktail.
The biggest one thing for us is just freshness and balance. You know, you don't want something too sweet. You don't want something too sour. And if you follow simple rules like 2-to-1 and 3/4, 3/4, 1.5, you're going to nail it every time. Simple rules. So like if you're ever making a sour, like a really simple way to make a sour is make sure that you're using equal parts juice and syrup, fresh citrus and syrup. And then you double that for your spirit, shake and strain, and you're almost always right on point. And actually, Emily kind of had the pro tip right there with the pinch of sea salt. Bartenders all across the country use a saline solution or a pinch of salt.
Saline solution?
Uh-huh. Yeah. So we do about a anywhere from a 20 to 30% saline solution. You can do that at home, just 20 grams of salt with 80 milliliters of water, and stir it till it's done, and add 2 drops to every cocktail, and you'll be amazed how much that helps the balance.
But this doesn't seem like an especially like summer tip. Wouldn't that be always the tip?
I would say an always the tip anytime you're using fresh citrus.
Emily, what are your thoughts about summer cocktails in particular? Now, we're friends, and I know that you don't You don't love summer.
I don't. I despise summer. Actually, I put the recipe for this drink, if it'd be a one set, up on my blog today. It's theboozybungalow.com. And I do talk about how much I hate summer. but I think that's why I love summer drinks so much, because you have to cool off and I want something really refreshing. And I don't like drinks that are super sweet. This is kind of on the line for me as far as sweetness. But I like a really balanced drink is in any season, obviously. But I also have a weird thing. I don't like to eat fruit, but I love fruit in cocktails. And so whenever, especially citrus and, just a good balance of, citrus and something sweet. And whenever possible, maybe some effervescence, some club soda, some bubbles.
I am embarrassed to say I'm not sure why. There is a third beverage in front of
me. No. That's just for you to smell. That's just some basil simple syrup put in front of you. I brought a lid, and you can take that home, Gina, and make your own drinks with basil simple syrup.
So this is just the basil simple syrup.
I just wanted you to smell it.
Okay, it smells really
good. You can drink it if you want.
There is a strong basil aroma in here, and it's probably partly that I've got basil simple syrup right under my nose. Yes. So talk to me about serving these drinks. I mean, okay, Brock, in your case, you've brought in basil cello, and as we've mentioned, it's bright green. When you put it in a cocktail, how do you work with it?
So we
visually.
So we actually, the intent was to have a bright green cocktail, so it's very eye-catching and appealing. And, I mean, the first thing I think most people do is, they eat with their eyes, they drink with their eyes, we see it every day. Oh, what's that? I want one of those, and so to have this bright green drink, we didn't want to muck it up with anything else. So every other liqueur we put with it is clear. And so the drink itself stays bright green. You can see it on our Instagram. It's called the El Pili, and we garnish it with an orange slice and some black Himalayan sea salt. So it has kind of an edginess to it. It's really great.
The Monarch Bar, I mean, for people who are sort of new to your space, it's the concept of the bar is very seasonal, and it involves butterflies.
Absolutely. So we actually took a lot of inspiration from bars all across the world, and especially when designing the menu. We have about 60 drinks on the cocktail list itself, and so we like to say that we have a cocktail for every type of person. Like anyone who comes in, I can find them something that they're going to enjoy.
And it's somewhere on the path of the monarch butterflies migration.
So the monarch butterflies travel over 3,000 miles every year, and it's just kind of crazy for something that weighs less about as much as a dime. It's unreal. And so we took that inspiration in our name of the monarch, and we used it to create paths, which allowed us to use seasonal and fresh ingredients along those paths and pair them with liqueurs all across the world.
So the El Pili is the one that uses basil cello.
Uh-huh.
Anything else with a summery ingredient you want to get us excited about?
I think one of my new favorite cocktails on the menu is the Strawberry Hill. It's a rhubarb-infused white rose wine aperitif with J. Rieger & Co. gin, which is local made here. And then we basically make a French 75 out of it with some rosé. It's really great.
And Emily...
Sorry, Kansas City. It also has Kansas City Can & Co.'s Strawberry Champagne Jam.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Emily, before we go, any other tips on basil? Because the whole inspiration for this is that people have more basil than they know what to do with if they're gardeners.
Yeah, just have fun with it. I also make a basil mint syrup that I like to put in a whiskey lemonade. You don't have to put whiskey in it. You can put it in just any old lemonade. You could make a basil syrup, and you said this tasted kind of like a popsicle. You could use it for popsicles. You could, blend strawberries and yogurt and some basil syrup. You can use it in all kinds of applications. So I really like making these flavorful, fragrant herbal syrups because you can really use them across the board.
Are there any other herbs you like to use in your drinks?
I really love using mint, and that's a pretty standard cocktail garnish. What else? I love rosemary in my drinks. I use that more in the fall and the winter because it does have warmer notes, but it can work in a summer drink as well.
Well, we are just about out of time. Any parting words on basil before we go?
Just use it. Put it in everything this summer because you'll regret it when winter comes and it's all dead.
Eat it, drink it, use it up.
Well, Brock Schulte of Monarch Bar, it's been great meeting you, and thanks for talking to us about your basil cello, which is on your Pili. It's a drink on your current summer menu.
Thank you.
And Emily Ferris of Sidework Studio, thanks for this summer cocktail.
Thank you.
And that is a wrap. You can catch anything you missed on today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we keep all of our content. So anything you've missed this week, you'll find it there. Our portrait session with Tim Finn is online now at kcur.org. That's including the pictures by Paul Andrews. So check that out while you're there. Portrait sessions are intimate, hour-long conversations with some of the most interesting people in Kansas City. And if you have an idea of someone we should talk to, let us know. Email centralstandard@kcur.org. You can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. And this show is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross, Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and Jen Chen, with help from intern Trevor Hook and Alfred Friendly fellow Anna Yukatenko, and KCUR's Matthew Long Middleton. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.